Talking with Dr. E. Richard Atleo, he is the author of Sawak, A New Chotanal Worldview. It's a book that has recently been published by paperback by UBC Press. I'm Paul Nelson. Your great-grandfather, Kista, as I understand, the last of the old-time whalers. Quite a process involved in capturing a whale at that time. Can you tell us about what time that was? What, about 125 years ago? Is that accurate?
Yes, somewhere in that neighborhood. We don't really know for certain, except it was the latter part of the 19th century. And he being born circa 1860, and nobody really knows exactly when he was born either. But elders remember him as being rather old at the turn of the century. Not really old, but he was quite a mature man. And settlement did not really seriously take place in our part of the world until the turn of the century, when people began to bring livestock and so on out to the coast and build their homes there. And even then, it was several decades before the full impact of civilization began to erode our way of life. Kista, then, having lived his adult life growing up and heading a house into which I was born, lived as the way of his ancestors did and taught me those same ways, so that in the beginning, as a three-year-old or four-year-old child, I would have to tupswis, which is simply the beginning of training for usumch. And as a small child, then before breakfast, made to run down to the beach and dive in the ocean and come back. And that was it. That was tupswis, but very important initial training process. Kista himself, as a whaler, would practice what we've called usumch, which I have called a knowledge acquisition methodology. That is, a method to acquire knowledge, a method to access knowledge from the spiritual realm. And so for that purpose, he would isolate himself for long periods of time and fast and pray and deny himself the physical pleasures of the world in order to focus on the spiritual concerns that he had, assuming that the spiritual dimension had power, had knowledge, had treasures that he could access through a correct methodology. Now, science, the fundamental requirement in successful scientific experimentation, the classical form, was neutrality. Scientists attempted to be neutral in their observations so as not to bias the information that
You're talking about being objective.
Being objective, exactly. Now, of course, this has been challenged by feminist theory, and rightly so. However, there's a lot of credence to the classical form of research created this technology and continues to create marvelous technology. So it has served classical science and scientific methodology is very legitimate. I sometimes find difficulty because I'm thinking in the channel and then that gets in the way. Usumch is also a methodology, and when it's practiced, the critical stance in usumch, according to our origin stories, this is what I call the insignificant leaf approach, according to one of our stories, where the swelled-headed approach of Son of Raven was unsuccessful in accessing the resource. But when he became an insignificant leaf, he was swallowed by the daughter of the great chief who owned the resources, and there was an immaculate conception, and she became pregnant. And so Son of Raven became then an inheritor of the resources owned by the chief, and that's how we got the light. So humility, then, is the proper stance in usumch. Just as objectivity is the proper stand in science. Now, if we merge the two together and make a more complete knowledge acquisition system, scientists will have to buy into the humility aspect, because without humility, there is no seeing in the spiritual realm. You cannot access Our stories are very plain that if you attempt, you know, to access information or any kind of resource from the spiritual domain, you'll not get the information you want.
That's one way to narrow the field. but your great-grandfather, and you, when you talk about Usamich, this is likened to a vision quest.
Yes, yes. The word Usamich has in it the root which means be careful. And so it's based on the view of reality that perceives it as along a spectrum which might be divided in two. On the one side, we might call it the dark, evil, destructive aspect of reality, and the other side, the beautiful, the creative, the glorious, the harmonious, the balance, all of those things that can describe Kwa'ut, owner of reality. And for some reason, creation, the design of creation is such that we don't understand why reality is this way. But we accept it and we embrace it. And so we create ceremonies and we create teachings to manage this reality as we perceive it through Usamich. We cannot perceive this reality with our physical eyes but more with our spiritual eyes through Usamich. Physical eyes, of course, will corroborate what we see through the spiritual realm. But the spiritual realm will give you a greater kind of certainty about the nature of reality than the physical realm. I know that empiricists, you know, will abhor this kind of statement, but
That's something we definitely have to follow up on before the interview is over. I do want to follow up on this notion how you don't necessarily think it's a great thing, but you realize it is the way it is, and you deal with it. For example, in Nuchaltnalth, the word for love includes the experience of pain. So right from the beginning, I mean, it's that pop song, "You Only Hurt the One You Love." Well, this is old news to you guys.
Yes, very, very interesting. I must explain that personally, I did not understand these concepts initially. I was not able to analyze these words and take them apart. Quite interestingly enough, it was after I had learned how to do that through the Western education system that I was able to take Ya'akmis, which is our word for love, and discover that it was the same word for pain. And when I spoke these at a conference where elders were present, they immediately could see that it was such wonder in their eyes, such affirmation in their bodies and body language. Yes, and they were speechless with wonder.
It was a revelation for them.
Revelation, exactly, yes.
Whereas I see the ladies in the audience now nodding their heads saying, yes, I know what that's all about. That's not a surprise to me. Well, there's another word in your language, and that is the title of the book is Sawak. How would you define Sawak?
Sawak literally in our language means one. Sawak atlaqat samu, 1, 2, 3, 4. Sawak means one. And initially, when I developed a theoretical concept around that, it was initially a theory of context because I perceived in my research at the university that every variable I examined had a context of conditions attached to that variable. And so that was the beginning. And with discussion with my professors, some of them also had the same kind of ideas. In education, they examined conditions. A student would be found in a certain set of conditions in the school. And so they examined those conditions. Or at home, they examined those conditions. So there were a set of identifiable contexts that scientific research could be conducted in. And over time, I realized that the word context is very useful in smaller situations. I needed one that was more inclusive of reality. And so I deliberately chose the Nuchaltnalth word because it doesn't come loaded with preconceptions, and so then I could define it as I saw fit. And of course, that's one of the prerogatives of academics is to do that, is to coin a word and then define it. And so it's inclusive then of spiritual and physical dimensions of reality as we perceive it, and spiritual being the preeminent dimension of reality upon which the physical depends and has all kinds of implications.
I was just going to say the interconnected nature of all reality. That might be a good definition for Tsawa.
Mm-hmm. Right. Yes, exactly.
Unlike Western culture, which suggests if you can't measure or see something, it is not real, the theory of Sawak assumes a spiritual primacy of existence.
Mm-hmm.
So things start from that realm, and everything in the physical realm, which we can touch or we can smell or we can feel or taste, these are a mere shadow of what begins in the spiritual realm. Is that accurate?
I would like to sort of back up, because so far we've been talking about the neutral worldview as rather proven kind of states of existence. And I really didn't want to give that impression. I really wanted to, when I wrote the book, I wrote the book as a propositional, from a propositional point of view. That is, when I spoke about generosity, for example, I didn't want to present it. I wanted to say that from a child perspective, it is a law. But when we move it into the research area, I want to present it as a proposition, that it must remain a proposition, because evidence from oral cultures, according to any definition from a scientific perspective, is not acceptable. Right. I would like, I am certain, I am very confident that the data, the information that are my ancestors, the legacy of my ancestors, the information that they produced, the data that they produced, the belief system that they have, can be subjected to credible, authentic, legitimate forms of research methodologies that scientists can recognize and approve of. Once they understand what we're trying to do, that if we subject it to authentic research, that some solid affirmation of data can be found, fact can be found, or credence can be given to information provided by acceptable research methodologies.
Well, let me go to then Newtonian science for a moment. The one that allegedly has been validated through double-blind placebo studies or what have you, and not just that science, but what gives it credence. You quote Thomas Hobbes in the book, a famous quote about life for indigenous people being nasty, brutish, and short. That's a paraphrase. Though his scientific modalities would be in question by any decent scientist, he's been allowed to shape attitudes towards indigenous peoples and also to shape laws for hundreds of years. Would you like to elaborate on that?
Well, that the quotation about Hobbes was there because a Supreme Court judge in British Columbia used Hobbes as evidence. One of the peculiarities of the Western culture is that if someone writes a book or writes a paper and it gets into a publication, and then over 100 years, something happens to that writing. It suddenly becomes hallowed. You know, it takes on an authenticity that it doesn't deserve, because it was written 200 years ago, because it was written 300 years ago, and that's an observation that I make. Shakespeare is literally an icon in all literatures, but if we really examine Shakespeare, what did he write about? You know, and I've never seen Shakespeare critiqued in a negative way. It's always been critiqued in a positive way.
You haven't talked to some of the poets I know, but that's okay. in terms of his poetry.
Oh, okay,
not his playwriting.
Sorry. Yeah, right. Okay, I should really stick to the subject here.
Well, no, but yeah. Hobbes, I mean, he's making this, and it's being quoted by a Supreme Court justice in Canada, and yet when you look at the scientific modality that of some of his contemporaries, for example, the early explorers and their scientific research was a lot more credible than what Hobbes was quoting.
Well, what Hobbes and Jean-Jacques Rousseau and John Locke, what they did at their time was acceptable. And it's very much like armchair quarterbacking. That is, they wrote down suppositions using logic, using their own logic. And so they, because they had access to the theory of evolution, that existence on the planet developed along an imaginary line called evolutionary line. And on this line, the most advanced species were the Europeans. And so they imagined that other species would be less advanced because they were not like them. And so they assumed that Aboriginals were more primitive along this evolutionary process, and to the point where they Aboriginals had no laws, they had no organized societies, and they were instinctive rather than intelligent, and they did not go and check their thoughts. They used their logic and applied the logic to their writings. Their writings are very logical, but flawed, seriously flawed. But that kind of work was acceptable at that time. And I think what's often forgotten, these people are still studied in political science. And so people that take political science learn incidentally about the primitiveness of Aboriginals. Balancing of the perception of individuals in those texts. There isn't another text that says, well, Hobbes had no evidence. Jean-Jacques Rousseau had no empirical evidence for the ideas that he propagated about Aboriginals.
He could have very well been throwing darts at a dartboard that he filled out and come up with similar results. We're talking with Dr. E. Richard Atleo. He is the author of Sawak, A New Chatham Worldview.